This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Tuesday, March the 31st, 2026. As is my custom, I'm going to start in the world section of today's monitor, and we'll work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, our first headline from today's world section of the monitor reads, "Out in space, Canada and the U.S. are getting along just fine." Geopolitics feels fraught these days, even between the closest of allies like Canada and the U.S. But the Artemis II moon launch is a reminder of how these two nations continue to work more closely together than ever in space. The date on this article is March the 31st. It is by Audrey Thibbert, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and the dateline is Boston. On the ground in Ottawa, Ontario, and Washington, Canadian-American relations are the worst they've been since the War of 1812. But the two neighbors are getting ready to send a group of four astronauts beyond the moon and back to push the boundaries of space exploration. Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen is expected to join three American colleagues for the upcoming Artemis II mission, a major NASA milestone for moon exploration. Weather permitting, the launch could happen as soon as April 1st. Mr. Hansen will be the first Canadian and first non-American to go on a mission around the moon. The American-Canadian team will lift off at a time when the United States and Canada are caught up in a trade war. President Trump has spent the last year threatening to annex Canada, and Prime Minister Mark Carney has become an advocate for middle powers establishing new global partnerships from military to trade that exclude the U.S. But those rifts have not yet divided the space arena, where the two countries are together sending a crew to do what only 24 people have ever done before, leave low Earth's orbit. The 10-day mission, which is the first journey to the moon by astronauts since 1972, is a point of national pride for Canada, with its much smaller space program, and the U.S. At a time of contentious geopolitics, it is also a moment to celebrate the wonder of exploration and working together to do so. The crew will include the first woman and person of color to ever fly around the moon, too. It's pushing a frontier, and that's what we do in exploration and discovery and science and research in general, says Julie Payette, veteran Canadian astronaut, engineer, and the former Governor General of Canada. We push that frontier of whatever the known world is, and at the moment, the frontier we have as humans in terms of physics is the moon. She adds, they're doing it not solely for one nation or solely for one people. The entire Artemis crew is going out there for everybody on Earth. Chris Hadfield, the first Canadian commander of the International Space Station and the first Canadian to walk in space, says he is proud to see a Canadian flag on the shoulder of Mr. Hansen's spacesuit among the other three American flags. It's a really lovely proof of, gosh, 65 years of cooperation between Canada and the U.S., he says. The Canadian astronaut program was established in 1983 with the first Canadian astronaut, the late Marc Garneau, flying to space the following year. In total, 14 Canadians have been trained as astronauts and 9 have taken part in missions to space. NASA lists more than 360 astronauts on its website. More than 320 have been on at least one spaceflight. In a promotional video for the Artemis mission, Mr. Hansen said that he is excited about getting to look back at Earth, just as the Apollo 8 astronauts did during their historic mission to the moon. This view that the Apollo 8 astronauts shared with the world will be seen by a Canadian for the first time, he said in the video. That makes me proud and excited for a new era of space exploration. Tim Hortons, the Canadian coffee brand, launched a limited edition box of Moon Bits, named after their tiny donut Timbits exclusively at select locations in London, Ontario, from where Mr. Hansen hails. And Canadian singer-songwriter M. Greiner released a new song, Touch the Sky, to celebrate the mission. The Canadian Space Agency website also lists 10 watch parties across Canada for the public to attend. Even Mr. Carney has weighed in, appearing in a video wishing Mr. Hansen good luck on his mission. While Canadians' feelings about the mission are overwhelmingly positive, sentiment toward the U.S. right now is not. Jake Robbins, Canadian host of the space podcast Off Nominal, describes the mood as very defensive. Still, Mr. Robbins says he hopes that amid the frustration in Canada directed at its southern neighbor, the Artemis mission will offer a brief moment when people can kind of stop and say, this is a cool thing that we're doing together, and we are exploring space together. It's hard to cast that in a negative light, he says. Each early cooperation between the Canadian Space Agency and NASA started in 1962 when NASA launched Canada's first satellite, Alouette 1. Then in 1974, the two signed an agreement to develop the Canada Arm 1, a robotic arm that attaches to space shuttles and was the first of a series of Canada arms. Canada Arm 2 is mounted on the International Space Station. Space has long been a place of cooperation between the U.S. and other countries, even its on-the-ground foes. Just decades after the 20th century space race between the U.S. and Soviet Union, the two countries worked together during the Cold War to launch the first crewed international human space flight in 1975. Today, the U.S. and Russia still communicate daily from ISS mission control centers in Houston and Moscow. Mr. Payette, who flew on two NASA space shuttle missions and spent more than 25 days in space, says that relationship is an example in the sky of cooperation. It's like a beacon in the sky, she says. While Russia remains a critical partner in the ISS, a multinational laboratory in space, with the U.S. and 13 other countries, China is not a partner. Instead, it is rapidly developing its own space capabilities, including those that would send humans to the moon by the end of the decade. That adds an urgency and a real strong reason to build on our combined strengths and not to just try and think that going it alone, you know, is the right thing to do, says Mr. Hadfield, who is also the author of the novel Final Orbit. And so I think this flight, Artemis II, is a really good result and example of long-term cooperation. For now, the cooperation seems easier to find in orbit than on Earth. And again, this particular article is by Audrey Thibbert, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Continuing on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor. This one reads, Why Pakistan Has Emerged as Key Mediator in U.S.-Iran War. Pakistan is leading the charge to bring the United States and Iran to the negotiating table, leaning on a budding friendship with Washington and deep ties to Tehran. But its role as mediator faces headwinds. The date on this article is March 30th. It is by Hassan Ali, who is a contributor at The Monitor. And the dateline is Islamabad. On the sidelines of a senior diplomatic meeting in Islamabad Sunday, Pakistani Foreign Minister Mohammad Ishaq Dar reiterated his country's commitment to helping end the war between the United States and Iran. Pakistan will be honored to host and facilitate meaningful talks between the two sides in coming days, he said, at the meeting attended by the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey. The goal, Mr. Dar added, is to reach a comprehensive and lasting settlement of the ongoing conflict, though it's not clear whether Washington or Tehran intends to participate. Still, the offer, which comes as the war enters its fifth week and just days after Pakistan said it opened a back channel between the U.S. and Iran, reflects Islamabad's growing confidence in its ability to shape global events. In the context of the U.S.-Iran war, it has reason to feel emboldened. By some estimates, Pakistan has the second largest number of Shiite Muslims after Iran, giving it the cultural capital to engage Tehran. Its leadership, both civilian and military, has grown close to the U.S. President Donald Trump over the past year and has a good working relationship with his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff. While there are other factors that might jeopardize Pakistan's position as an interlocutor, these relationships make it one of a handful of countries that can act as a go-between. Pakistan is the only country that has direct access to both the American leadership and the Iranian leadership, says Pakistani journalist Fahd Hussain. And not just access, but a level of trust which no other country enjoys. Yet, many in Pakistan question whether there is sufficient appetite among the warring parties to cease their hostilities. Iran has already rejected a U.S. peace plan delivered via Pakistan and has repeatedly said it does not intend to negotiate with the U.S. I do not think resolution through mediation is possible on the terms of the aggressor, said former Pakistani Prime Minister Shahid Khaqan Abbasi about Washington's proposal. Iran has absorbed the immense pain of a continuing unprovoked conflict. Indeed, even as a multinational effort to secure peace gains momentum, the fighting is escalating. Over the weekend, U.S. Central Command said an additional 3,500 sailors and Marines had been deployed in the region. Early Monday, the Israel Defense Forces said it was currently attacking government infrastructure throughout Tehran. Pakistan is one of 29 countries that do not recognize Israel, and analysts say it's difficult to imagine a way out of this war without buy-in from the Jewish state. The elephant in the room is Israel, which has been the tail wagging the dog, says Maliha Lodi, who served as Pakistan's permanent representative to the United Nations from 2015 to 2019. Israel can play the spoiler even if the U.S. and Iran reach an understanding to pause the fighting. So the unanswered question is whether Trump can restrain Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Pakistan is also having to placate its allies in the Gulf, many of which host American bases and have faced attacks by the Iranians. With Saudi Arabia in particular, Pakistan has a defense pact in which aggression against one is seen as aggression against both. So far, Islamabad has refused to interpret the attacks by Iran on Saudi Arabia as triggering the pact. But if the scale or intensity of Iranian strikes increases, Islamabad might find it more difficult to reject any call from Riyadh to enter the fray. That would be the worst-case scenario for Pakistan, and I think Saudi Arabia also understands that, says Mr. Hussein, the journalist. That would mean all efforts at diplomacy are dead and buried, and the final conclusion is going to take place on the battlefield. And I think no country, including Saudi Arabia, would want that. Pakistan sees peace as essential to avoid being embroiled in a wider regional war, as well as to maintain stability within its borders. After the assassination of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, considered a figure of reverence by many in Pakistan's Shiite minority, riots broke out in major cities across the country. And given Pakistan's heavy reliance on imported petroleum, there are concerns that the country's fragile economy won't be able to handle a sustained increase in oil prices. A similar uptick in energy prices after Russia invaded Ukraine contributed to an inflation crisis from which the country has only partially recovered. And again, this particular article is by Hassan Ali, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Continuing on from the world section, the next headline reads, "Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia, life calmly goes on amid Iran war." In stark contrast with residents of other Arab countries in the Gulf region, Saudis exhibit a decidedly blasé attitude toward the U.S.-Israel war with Iran. Conversations focus on jobs and the economy and reveal faith in their government's ability to provide security. The date on this article is March the 30th. It is by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and the datelines are Hail and Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Bags in hand at a Riyadh shopping mall, Hatem Shimri has a simple message. There is no war here, he says. Don't believe what you see on TV or read on Twitter. Life is going on as normal, and we are living our lives. Come to Riyadh and see for yourself. If Saudi Arabia is being dragged into a regional war, its citizens and residents say they don't feel it. Voicing a sense of calm is remarkably consistent. Neighboring Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates issue daily phone alerts for residents to shelter indoors from incoming Iranian drones and missiles that are hitting hotels and residential towers. But Saudis are out en masse in outdoor markets, shopping malls, food courts, and cafes. Across the country is a mixture of confidence, trust in its leadership and the United States security umbrella, and the belief that the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran will wrap up before its impact is felt in the kingdom. Saudi Arabia has perhaps the most to lose from a widening regional war, yet among Gulf Arab citizens, Saudis are worrying the least. Even an Iranian missile strike that wounded a dozen Americans at an air base an hour outside of Riyadh on Saturday didn't appear to shake the Saudis' confidence. While Saudi Arabia's oil exports reportedly have been reduced by 40% because of Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz, gas here is still $2.20 per gallon, one of the lowest prices in the world. Saudi Arabia imports 80% of its food, yet the prices of clothing, food, and electronics have not gone up, even as the conflict disrupts air travel and global shipping. While airports are closed in Kuwait City, Doha in Qatar, and Manama in Bahrain, and partially closed in Dubai and Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, dozens of domestic and international flights land and take off daily at Riyadh's gleaming King Khalid International Airport. To be sure, Iran and its proxy targets U.S. bases and infrastructure in the kingdom with missiles and drones on a daily basis, but the majority are knocked down by Saudi and U.S. air defenses at a cost of millions of dollars each day, contributing to Saudi's sense of safety and calm. Instead of the war, Saudis returning from Eid holidays talk of finding jobs, university studies, which stock to invest in, and where to vacation. Those who are not following the news closely outside the region may think Saudi Arabia and the Gulf is a region full of explosions and war, says Rakan Khatani, a fourth-year ophthalmology student in Riyadh. It's the wrong image. In conversations, both private and on the record, Saudis express a trust in their military and a feeling of security that is at odds with the rest of the Gulf. People are all going out freely. There is no fear. No problems have happened, says Faisal Muteb, a university student at King Saud University, who is hitting the streets in Riyadh to record interviews for an assignment. We have trust in our government and their orders. We know their thinking is completely in citizens' interests, he says. We are relaxed. As of Sunday, Iran had targeted the kingdom with 815 drones and 65 missiles, the Saudi defense ministry said. But Tilal, an Uber driver from Taif, said his concerns are not Iranian drones, but when he can land a steady job. We are all looking for stable work and building our future, says Tilal, who moved to Riyadh 3 months ago. For many of us from outside towns and villages, we are all coming to the capital to get ahead. We are focused on starting companies, completing our higher education degrees, says Noor, an entrepreneur in Riyadh who did not wish to use her full name. Saudi Arabia has gone through a transformation, and we are a growing economy and country. Our focus is development and progress, not war. In a crowded outdoor market in Riyadh, outside a mosque, prayer goers haggled on Friday over boxes of dates, incense, vegetables, and fruit. We Saudis only fear God. We want to live in peace. This is between two escalating sides, Iran and Israel. It is not our war, and the war hasn't reached here, says Khaled Rahman, selling nuts and spices from the back of a pickup truck, along with his most popular item, Iranian saffron, a key ingredient in Saudi coffee. A lone jet roared overhead. Later, the Ministry of Defense said it destroyed six ballistic missiles and two Iranian drones targeting Riyadh that day. On Iran, the only future is for us to live side by side, says Mr. Rahman with a smile. Besides, he adds, their saffron is the cleanest. Living a normal life is not ignorance, but a deliberate show of strength and resilience, says Khalil Shamiri, a retired businessman in Hail in northern Saudi Arabia. Every Saudi knows the cost of this war, he notes, but we won't stop our joy celebrating Eid, working or enjoying life. Iran can't intimidate us. Supporters for the security partnership with the support for the security partnership with the U.S. is high, and there's a general sense that the kingdom's fortunes lie with a continued alliance with Washington. Ibrahim, a university student from Mecca, who did not wish to use his full name, says he spotted an Iranian drone over Riyadh 2 days earlier that was knocked down. Like many, he is confident the kingdom's security and economy will hold up, but is eager to see the Iranian regime finished. Americans must finish the job. We can't live next to an Iran that hits every country and holds the world hostage. We know the Americans won't just start a war and leave, he says. The Iranians don't have a single friend in this world for a reason. They don't behave like a normal state. All wanted the kingdom and other Gulf states to avoid entering the war and escalating the conflict. If Gulf states weren't wise, they would hit Iran right back, says Waleed Sharif, a Riyadh driver. But instead, they practiced restraint, because Gulf states know if they enter the war, even if they win, there will be large costs to their economy, to the lives of their people, he says. At the same time, Saudis told the Monitor they would support Saudi offensive action against Iran should it damage the country's critical infrastructure. The Crown Prince gave the Ministry of Defense orders to strike Iran if they target our desalination or electricity networks. Water and energy are the red line, says Ibrahim. If we strike Iran, all the country will be united backing it. And again, this particular article was by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. So our next headline from the world section of today's Monitor brings us back to Europe. And it reads, for security at home and across Europe, France offers nuclear deterrence. French President Emmanuel Macron has laid out a new policy on nuclear deterrence that extends beyond the borders of France. The date on this particular article is March 29th. It is by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. And the dateline is Paris, France. The French leader who steered his nation out of Nazi occupation and into the height of the Cold War was guided by a simple conviction. France cannot be France without greatness, Charles de Gaulle wrote in the opening lines of his memoir. For Mr. de Gaulle, the World War II general and French president from 1959 to 1969, greatness included Paris getting the bomb. He oversaw the country's first nuclear test in 1960, making France the fourth nation on Earth to acquire nuclear weapons. Always wary about putting too much trust in his allies, Mr. de Gaulle's objective was first to safeguard France, but he also described obtaining nuclear arms as rendering a service to the balance of the world. Following in those footsteps, President Emmanuel Macron has announced the most significant update to France's nuclear policy in decades. These changes include the expansion of the country's atomic arsenal and the extension of French nuclear deterrence beyond its borders. In a speech to French naval officers in Brittany on March 2nd, Mr. Macron talked about a new forward deterrence nuclear strategy, marking a pivotal moment for the defense of Europe. To be powerful is to be more united, the president said, standing in front of a French nuclear-powered submarine called Le Temeraire, the Daring One, which carries nuclear-armed long-range ballistic missiles. Today, as Russia's war on Ukraine threatens Europe and the Trump administration casts doubt on U.S. commitments to NATO, French leaders say they must contribute to regional security in new ways. Since he returned to the White House, President Donald Trump has suspended aid to Ukraine, lifted sanctions on Russian oil sales, and warned NATO that it faced a, quote, very bad future if alliance members refused to help secure the Straits of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz. The shipping lane for oil and natural gas through the Persian Gulf was blocked after the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran in late February. There is now a growing sense in Europe that if Russia were to carry out military aggression beyond Ukraine, the United States may not come to the rescue. Still, there are limits to how far France will go. The country is believed to possess around 300 nuclear warheads, and that number is set to go up under Mr. Macron's policy shift. The U.S. and Russia have more than 5,000 warheads each, together accounting for nearly 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. However, France is vague about the precise number of warheads it has. That ambiguity, say observers, is a key part of its strategy to keep the continent safe and create a stronger, more independent Europe. The risk of a nuclear conflict is higher today than at any point since the end of the Cold War, says Daryl G. Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association, an advocacy group based in Washington. In the event of a major crisis, Europe needs to be able to stand up on its own. Make no mistake, France's forward deterrence strategy is not a U.S.-style nuclear umbrella in which France would guarantee the defense of non-nuclear states, nor is it meant to replace NATO protections. It is a supplementary guarantee to complement what already exists, says Yannick Pince, an associate history professor at the Sorbonne Nouvelle University. And despite some of the threatening rhetoric coming from the U.S., from U.S. officials toward their European allies, officially, all the American guarantees towards NATO are upheld, Mr. Pince says. France has said its updated defense policy may involve cooperation with European partners in future military exercises or the possible deployment of French military forces on an ad hoc basis. Defense experts say that could translate into the temporary or permanent stationing of nuclear-capable French military aircraft in allied countries and may potentially even include French nuclear weapons. The policy shift could see France calling on partners to ready their air bases and storage facilities for French atomic weapons. Already, at least, one of France's armed ballistic missile submarines remains on deterrent patrol at all times. But unlike the NATO model, in which a European plane may be equipped with a U.S. nuclear warhead, Paris's strategy is French through and through, according to the French Ministry of Armed Forces. French nuclear deterrence will remain national, independent, autonomous, and sovereign, the ministry said in an email response to questions from the Monitor. Its potential use will remain the exclusive prerogative of the President of the French Republic. In some ways, the French desire for nuclear sovereignty is nothing new. Since the presidency of Mr. de Gaulle, France has never fully embraced the U.S. approach to nuclear deterrence. Up until 2009, France refused to join NATO's Integrated Military Command, and it remains the only NATO member that is not part of the NATO Nuclear Planning Group, which works to enhance communication between member states on nuclear issues. Under its new nuclear strategy, however, Paris is expected to cooperate with its European partners, initially through bilateral discussions. The French government has remained intentionally vague about who and what it intends to protect with its nuclear forces, only referring to its vital interest. Again, strategic ambiguity appears to be an important part of the plan. While the French government plans to boost the size of its nuclear arsenal, it also intends to keep specifics about the number, location, and performance of its nuclear warheads more secret than before. Already the maps of France that appear on Google Earth are more sanitized than other nuclear-armed states, and a 2008 law intended to limit the spread of France's nuclear information has made it difficult to independently verify specific elements of its nuclear program. A spokesperson for France's Atomic Energy Commission said it would not be going public with any new information about the country's nuclear testing or preparedness. This is all part of the psychological posture that Paris presents to its adversaries, says General Bruno Clermont, a defense consultant and retired aeronautical security director within the Ministry of Armed Forces. But France is not alone on an island in the Pacific, says Mr. Clermont. From the birth of nuclear deterrence, it was clear that France's vital interests were not linked solely to France itself, but to France within a wider whole. Despite talking about extending nuclear deterrence, Mr. Macron denied entering a new nuclear arms race. France has been a signatory of the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons since 1992 and has complied with its provisions since 1968, when the treaty was signed by the U.S. and U.K. The French nuclear strategy focuses on the power of deterrence, not the use of nuclear weapons, in the event of foreign aggression, says defense experts. If there is a crisis, the decision to use a nuclear weapon will be the most significant decision in the 21st century, says Mr. Kimball, the arms control expert. Defense experts say the more likely scenario would be in the form of a conventional attack, most likely from Russia. That threat has led leaders across Europe bolstering their traditional military programs. France, Germany, Croatia, and Romania have reinstated voluntary or mandatory national service this year, while Poland and Belgium are debating compulsory service. Since Russia has dramatically ramped up its nuclear threats against the West in recent years. Still, Russia has dramatically ramped up its nuclear threats against the West in recent years. That means nuclear deterrence remains a powerful tool in diminishing the chance of conflict with Russia, says Luigi Gazieri, a senior policy analyst at the European Union Institute for Security Studies. Even a year ago, countries weren't willing to even talk about it, he says. Others, however, say the escalating rhetoric on nuclear weapons could set a dangerous precedent. During the Cold War, we all feared nuclear war, but now we're not afraid, says Nikolai Sokov, senior fellow at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Nonproliferation. When you stop fearing nuclear war or pursue policies to use it, you're getting that much closer to it becoming reality. And once again, this particular article was by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. And here's one final article from today's World section of The Monitor. The headline reads, "From Diplomatic Credibility to Oil Prices, the War in Iran is Costing India." The Iran war is simultaneously undercutting India's energy security, remittances, and geopolitical influence, making Delhi one of the biggest losers in a war it isn't even fighting. The date on this article is March the 28th. It is by Akash Hassan, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and the dateline is New Delhi. The war in Iran is hitting India hard. The rupee slumped to a record low of 94.7875 per dollar Friday, as the upheaval in the Middle East disrupted remittances and energy imports. And India's stock market fell for the fifth consecutive week as oil and gas prices continued to rise. Meanwhile, arch-rival Pakistan has emerged as a critical back-channel intermediary in the conflict, a role that highlights India's absence from diplomatic channels it has long sought to shape. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, accused by the opposition of undermining India's diplomatic neutrality, described the overall situation as worrisome. Indeed, the war in Iran is becoming both an economic and a strategic nightmare for Delhi. For decades, India balanced ties with Iran, Israel, and Gulf states, positioning itself as a potential interlocutor. This approach allowed New Delhi to stay relevant across rival blocs without being drawn into them. But now the strategy is facing fierce headwinds. Praveen Donthi, senior India analyst at the International Crisis Group, says the recent fallout exposes the limits of India's balancing act in West Asia. After over a decade of a favorable global environment, India has entered more turbulent waters, he says, pointing to friction after last year's India-Pakistan crisis, disagreements over U.S. mediation, and trade tensions. The war in Iran, he says, has plunged India into deeper trouble. India imports nearly 85% of its crude oil, with much of it passing through the Strait of Hormuz. Even limited disruption raises shipping costs, insurance premiums, and crude prices, feeding inflation and pressuring the rupee. More than any other conflict, including its own with Pakistan, this war could have the greatest impact on India's economy, says Mr. Donthi. The impacts extend beyond energy. Around 10 million Indians live in Gulf countries, sending home more than $40 billion annually, roughly a third of India's remittance inflow. Any slowdown in Gulf economies hits household incomes and domestic demand. The war feels very close, says Wasim Khan, who hails from Uttar Pradesh in India and now works as a construction worker in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. My job is under threat because of the conflict, and back home, my family is dealing with the crisis of cooking gas. If war escalates, it's going to affect Indians the most, here and back home. Together, energy disruptions and remittance risk create a dual shock, widening the current budget deficit and slowing growth. However, the deeper setback is geopolitical. In late February, Mr. Modi stood alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv, the two leaders greeting each other with an embrace. Over 2 days, they signed agreements upgrading ties to a special strategic partnership spanning defense, technology, agriculture, and innovation. Less than 2 days after the visit, Israel and the United States launched the military offensive against Iran. The timing placed India in an immediate bind. For days, New Delhi remained publicly silent, an unusual pause for a country that has long projected itself as a balancing power in the region. Despite India's claims of neutrality, the optics of Modi's visit to Israel at a moment of looming conflict effectively placed it in the Israel camp, says Mr. Donthi. The space for diplomatic maneuvering has shrunk considerably. It took several days for New Delhi to make limited outreach to Iran, including a condolence visit by a senior official. Since then, engagement has been cautious and largely driven by energy concerns. Public messaging has also been uneven. While India condemned attacks on Israel and some Gulf partners, it has been more restrained in responding to strikes on Iran. The muted reaction has drawn criticism at home, with opposition leaders accusing the government of weakening India's credibility as a neutral actor. The structure of our foreign policy has been demolished, India's main opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, told reporters Tuesday. Prime Minister Modi cannot fix it. He will only do what America and Israel will tell him to do. Asim Ali, an independent political researcher and columnist based in Delhi, says the timing of Mr. Modi's visit to Israel sent a clear signal. This is a departure from its role as a balancing power, he says, and it has cost India diplomatic capital. Countries such as Pakistan are prepared to fill the void. For New Delhi, Pakistan's rise as an unexpected mediator is not just a symbolic blow. It undercuts India's long-standing efforts to present itself as the more credible and stable interlocutor in the region. For years, Mr. Modi has argued that India's economic weight, political stability, and friendly ties along West Asia and around the world make it the best choice for Vishwaguru, literally meaning global guide, a country able to bridge rival blocs and shape outcomes in a multipolar world. In this crisis, however, India has found itself reacting to events rather than influencing them. And this particular article, once again, was by Akash Hassan, who is a contributor at the Monitor. With that, we're going to move right along to the USA section of today's Monitor. And our first headline reads, Trump paid TSA agents while Congress was gridlocked. Can he do that? President Donald Trump's executive action got TSA agents paid, but it challenges Congress's power of the purse. The date on this article is March the 31st. It is by Ross Herbert, who is a contributor at the Monitor, and the dateline is Washington, D.C. President Donald Trump's creative funding solution to bypass congressional gridlock might ease multi-hour airport security lines in the short term. However, it relies on a legal rationale that is more complex and contested than the White House's framing suggests, which analysts say erodes congressional budget powers. The president's executive action on Friday declared the lack of funding for Transportation Security Administration employees and the mess it created at major airports an emergency situation compromising the nation's security. By Monday, the agency announced most of its agents had been paid. The memorandum had instructed the budget office to find other funds within the Department of Homeland Security that could be used to pay airport security agents. The hitch is that the Constitution gives spending authority to Congress. Mr. Trump is not the first president to try pushing the boundaries of the executive's role in directing government funding. In effect, money can only be spent for the purposes spelled out by the legislative branch, and presidents cannot shuffle funds from one purpose to another without congressional authorization, according to U.S. law. The president's allies in Congress seem happy to see him do this, even though it does erode their power in the long run, which means more and more power accumulating in the executive branch, says Zachary Price, a professor at the University of California College of Law in San Francisco. Mr. Price wrote an academic article in February reviewing the history of spending tussles between Congress and the executive branch. The Friday memorandum does not say which DHS accounts will be used. The most likely source is a $10 billion fund set up under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that was established to keep DHS agencies running if Congress could not agree on funding. The act is vague about the purpose the funds can be used for, noting that the money can be used for reimbursement of costs incurred in undertaking activities in support of the Department of Homeland Security's mission to safeguard the borders of the United States. Excuse me. The bill also provides $12 billion for DHS to reimburse costs for activities in support of securing U.S. borders. This provision does not define who could be reimbursed, likely allowing it to be used to reimburse states, localities, and tribal governments, as well as other agencies within the department for expenses associated with securing U.S. borders. I don't think there is a sound legal basis for the order, says David Super, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a specialist in legislation related to the federal budget. If there was one, they would have spelled it out. The problem of president spending without authorization goes well beyond President Trump. President Barack Obama spent funds outside of authorization in a number of cases, including maintaining Affordable Care Act subsidies without a congressional appropriation. President Joe Biden halted construction of a border wall, even though Congress had appropriated funds for it. He also notably tried to spend around $400 billion to forgive student loans, which the Supreme Court ruled had no congressional authorization. Professor Price wrote in his article that recent presidents have repeatedly taken legally aggressive actions in arguable defense of appropriation enactments, and the scale and brazenness of some such actions give reason to worry that legal limits on unilateral executive spending choices are fraying. Though the laws are clear that Congress has the power of the purse, challenging unauthorized presidential spending is a persistent problem. Professor Super notes that when Mr. Trump paid troops during the government shutdown last October, he said the funds would be taken from Defense Department research and development accounts. That was an illegal transfer, said Professor Super. The anti Deficiency Act makes it a crime, a felony, to spend money without authorization. Whoever committed funds last fall committed a crime, but no one in the Justice Department has an interest in challenging that. The Attorney General could challenge the legality of executive branch spending, but being part of the same branch makes such an action unlikely. When President Biden attempted to forgive student debt without authorization, the legal challenge came not from his government, but from states that showed their student loan collection bodies would suffer damages under the debt forgiveness. The Supreme Court has ruled that individual members of Congress can't sue over the executive branch spending funds outside of congressional authorization. The entire House of Representatives, or Senate, could theoretically challenge in court, but that has not happened. When the same party controls both the White House and Congress, there is little political interest in challenging the president. So, one route could be to just avoid the sort of government shutdowns that motivated this particular spending decision, even though it wouldn't resolve other instances of presidents writing checks that Congress hasn't authorized. G. William Hoagland, a budget expert at the Bipartisan Policy Center who served 25 years as a Senate staffer on budget and appropriations matters, argues that the House and Senate should enact rules that automatically extend funding in the event of such disputes. So far, it doesn't have enough support in Congress, perhaps in part because the shutdowns create leverage that partisans can use to score political points. Congress is already midway through the government's fiscal year and is still tied up arguing over current year funding. They are way behind schedule, which means we will be seeing shutdown pressures on the next budget, Mr. Hoagland said. His proposal would eliminate the drama, he says. If, by the start of the year, Congress has not passed all 12 federal budget bills, all funding would continue on an automatic continuation. And again, this particular article was by Ross Herbert, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's USA section of The Monitor, this one reads, "The Apollo missions sent astronauts to the moon. With Artemis, NASA wants them to stay." The Artemis II mission will take astronauts beyond low Earth orbit for the first time in 50 years. This next era of the U.S. space program marks a step toward building a permanent presence in outer space. The date on this article is March the 31st. It is by Henry Gass, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. The Artemis program's space launch system has a maximum speed of more than 24,000 miles per hour, but it still isn't fast enough to escape comparisons to Apollo 11. Yet, those preparing the SLS, to use its NASA-designated acronym, have loftier ambitions than matching the Apollo program in taking humans to the moon and returning them safely. The Artemis program, which uses the SLS as its main launch vehicle, aims to both return Americans to the moon and begin creating a long-term human presence in outer space. Artemis is NASA's first venture in what can be described as the third era of human space travel. The 1960s race between the United States and Soviet Union to land a man on the moon is viewed as the first era. It ended with a definitive American victory when Neil Armstrong planted the U.S. flag on the lunar surface in July 1969. The second era, emboldened by the space shuttle and the International Space Station, heralded a focus on reusability as well as cooperation between nations and the private sector. The third era is a blend of the previous two. Both the U.S. and China are pushing to return humans to the moon by the end of this decade. Meanwhile, international coalitions and private aerospace companies are sketching out ambitious visions for a lunar-centered space economy that can advance technology on Earth and help fuel, literally, further exploration into deep space. The Artemis program is huge. It is historic. But it's also important that it is not a flags and footprint thing anymore, says Jan Osberg, a senior engineer at RAND. We have the technology, we should have the management capability and the political will to make it something that lasts beyond just a handful of missions, he adds. NASA aims to launch the Artemis II mission as soon as April 1st. The roughly 10-day mission aims to fly four astronauts around the moon and back to Earth, testing the SLS, the Orion spacecraft, and every other engineering and communication system that NASA and its private partners have built for the Artemis program. The mission will take astronauts beyond low Earth orbit for the first time in 50 years, and the four-person crew will include the first woman, the first person of color, and the first Canadian to fly around the moon. The Artemis name is a nod to other NASA eras. In Greek mythology, Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo. This year's mission follows Artemis 1 in 2022, which performed an uncrewed orbital flight around the moon. The Artemis 4 mission, tentatively scheduled for 2028, is when NASA hopes to land humans on the moon for the first time in more than half a century. The 2028 timeline is notable. China has been making steady progress with its own lunar exploration program, the Chang'e project, and aims for a moon landing by 2030. Not much information comes out from the China National Space Administration, but observers say that Chang'e is enjoying steady progress, aided by the country's autocratic government being able to fund the program as it sees fit. It has all the hallmarks of a new space race. For NASA, that might not be a bad thing. Portraying this as a new space race like the 1960s can be an effective political argument that frees up money from the White House and Congress despite demands to reduce the deficit, says Marcia Smith, a veteran space policy analyst. I'm not sure it's actually true, but it's an effective argument politically and financially at this time. Some in the space exploration community say a longer-term outlook is needed. Getting humans back to the moon first might have symbolic significance, but this era of space travel will be defined by achieving a long-term human presence beyond low Earth orbit. In that context, some experts say rushing might be the wrong approach. Sustained human presence on the moon is an ultra-marathon, not a sprint, says Bruce McClintock, head of the Space Enterprise Initiative at RAND. A century from now, in my view, nobody is really going to care who got there first. In January 2025, Elon Musk, the billionaire founder of private space company SpaceX, described the moon as a distraction from Mars. Just over a year later, however, he has changed his tune. SpaceX has already shifted focus to building a self-growing city on the moon, he wrote in a social media post on February 8th. The overriding priority is securing the future of civilization, and the moon is faster. A stated long-term goal of NASA is to expand permanent human presence beyond low Earth orbit. Artemis is intended to lay groundwork for that permanent human presence. This government-led effort, NASA hopes, could lead to a new space economy on or around the moon. There is some skepticism, however. The idea of a sustained presence on the moon is orders of magnitude more complicated than just sending somebody to the moon, says Mr. McClintock. This process was scheduled to begin with Artemis IV and the construction of a small moon-orbiting space station known as Lunar Gateway. The station would allow astronauts to live for extended periods in space, conduct scientific experiments, more easily access the lunar surface, and stage for missions to Mars and into deep space. With Artemis IV now focused on a lunar landing, however, the proposed station has been sidelined. In late March, NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman said the agency is pausing Gateway in its current form and focusing on infrastructure that supports sustained operations on the lunar surface. In turn, as Mr. Musk's dream of a moon city illustrates, this presence could lead to private industry establishing a new economy beyond low Earth orbit. Most experts agree that won't happen overnight, however. I don't think people really comprehend the difficulty, says Ms. Smith, the space policy analyst. The lunar South Pole is attracting lots of scientific and commercial interest, for example. It is believed to hold large amounts of water ice, a resource that is chemically different from ice on Earth, and should be vital for human missions and settlements. This ice is in permanently shadowed craters, and these craters are at minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit, so mining that ice will be extraordinarily difficult, says Ms. Smith. This dynamic has already unfolded in low Earth orbit, which extends to about 1,200 miles above the planet's surface. From the 1980s through the 2010s, governments developed efficient ways to launch into this region of space. This enabled the construction and continued maintenance of the International Space Station. Launches to low Earth orbit, including the space station, are now routine. In 2025, SpaceX launched more than 120 Starlink communication satellites, averaging one launch every few days. The company's Starlink-based internet service is now its main revenue driver. But what helps make these services profitable is the relative affordability of accessing low Earth orbit. The moon is 100 times farther away, making it much more expensive and dangerous for companies to reach. Discussion so far has focused on ventures such as mining the moon for critical minerals, as well as building private space stations for research, manufacturing, and tourism. Recent surveys had found the moon to be rich in resources, including minerals, water ice, chemically complex deposits that could be turned into rocket fuel, and helium-3, which could be used as fuel for nuclear fusion. The lunar economy could be worth around $170 billion over the next two decades, according to a 2021 PricewaterhouseCoopers analysis. NASA has partnered with a variety of commercial space companies in the hopes of stimulating a self-sustaining economy on or around the moon. The discussions are almost entirely hypothetical. Few private companies have consistently launched a rocket beyond low Earth orbit. Space is a very, very hostile environment, and it's chokingly expensive, says Joan Johnson Fries, a senior fellow with Women in International Security and a former professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I don't think we can say much about a potential space economy until we have routine access to the moon. Otherwise, it's aspirational rather than real. When humanity first began venturing into space, only the United States and the Soviet Union were involved. That has changed dramatically over the past six decades. More than 70 nations had space programs as of 2023, and international collaboration has defined space exploration since the space race. Astronauts from 26 countries have visited the International Space Station. Key partners on Lunar Gateway include the European, Japanese, Canadian, and United Arab Emirates space agencies. NASA has also been gathering global signatories to its Artemis Accords. Drafted in 2020, the accords lay out best practices to enhance the governance of civil exploration and use of outer space. 61 nations had signed on to the agreement as of January. Two notable exceptions are China and Russia. China is looking for 50 countries to join its International Lunar Research Station project, a scientific outpost planned for the lunar South Pole. Russia is China's main partner on the project, but other nations have signed on as well. 17 countries and international organizations have joined, the Chinese government announced last year. Both programs describe themselves as science-focused, but as the U.S. and China advance their respective moon missions, the geopolitical undercurrents are undeniable. They are deliberately trying to pull undecided nations into their orbit, says Mr. Osberg, the RAND engineer. That doesn't necessarily mean there has to be a conflict between those two. Hopefully, as lunar exploration is going to take place, there will be cooperation between these two different systems and organizations. How meaningful these multinational agreements are in the long term remains to be seen. As America recalibrates its leadership role, there are concerns that changes on Earth could have ripple effects in outer space, and that could have consequences for every nation aiming for the stars. Both China and Russia have had spacecraft hit by space debris recently, for example, and space debris is only expected to become a bigger problem in the coming years. Things like space debris can only be dealt with on an international basis, says Dr. Johnson Fries. We've had that international cooperation in the past. How long it can continue, I think, is a big question. For now, with the Artemis program funded by Congress through 2032, the U.S. is a leader in returning humans to the moon. After two launch delays, Artemis II is hoping to lift off early April. A successful lap around the moon would represent one small step toward returning to the footprints first left by Apollo 11. John Logsdon was at Cape Kennedy that July morning in 1969. He saw the Saturn V rocket light up, and he heard the roar as it climbed through a blue sky toward the moon. It was exhilarating, recalls Dr. Logsdon, a professor emeritus at George Washington University and founder of its Space Policy Institute. No Artemis launch will compare, he adds, but he is excited for the U.S. to go back. Going the second time is never going to have the impact of going the first time, he says, but if we're going to go into space, we should explore. We should go beyond Earth's orbit. And once again, this particular article was by Henry Gass, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you joining me to listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor later this week. Thank you for listening.